Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents War Dogs, Heading Home by A.J. Newman, narrated by Roger Wayne. Chapter 1, March 15, 2038. TSHTF minus 10 days. TSHTF equals the shit hit the fan. Heathrow Airport, London, UK. Another patrol, another day in hell, thought Staff Sergeant Jason Walker. The jihadists were sniping and blowing up our units who were trying to take back Heathrow Airport in London. The war in Europe was certainly a living hell for us war dogs, but it was a piece of cake compared to the end of the world as we knew it. I was always the one to crack a joke to help raise the spirits of my fellow soldiers when we fought and died across Belgium, France, and Germany. We kicked the damn Syrians, Iranians, and Russians out of Europe. And then the enemy shocked us with a surprise invasion of England. My unit, the War Dogs, was part of the 101st Airborne Division. One War Dog handler and canine were assigned to each squad. Max and I had made over 24 jumps together. 7 were in combat. We were the first into London, and the first to see all of the headless men, women, and children. I haven't cracked a joke since then. And I'd be hard-pressed to tell one now. I had to settle for the joke being on the Iranians, because they tried to do their best to kill me and failed. The 3rd Brigade of the 101st Airborne Division, the War Dogs, was highly regarded as the best at finding and killing the enemy. We had killed more than any 3 other units combined, and my squad had most of those kills. Max, my black and tan Belgian Malinois MWD military working dog, and I even went on missions while the others slept. I didn't need much sleep. The problem for me was that I had begun to like the up-close and personal killing. Even in my exhausted state, I knew this was wrong. Max was born at Lackland Air Force Base and was a product of the Defense Department's Military Working Dog Breeding Program, also known as the Puppy Program. The puppies were fostered out until they were mature enough to return for training. Max and I first met there, and we trained and bonded at Lackland. The staff trained Max to become a warrior dog and prepared me to support him. Max was trained to detect explosives, alert at an enemy ambush, catch and take down a fleeing bad guy, and to stop attacking if I yelled, "Out!" The extra M designates that Max was born at Lackland and not purchased from a civilian source. I always tell the other soldiers the first M was for mad, and don't make Mad Max mad or he'll bite your ass. Max was highly trained and would not hurt anyone unless they threatened him or me. Of course, if I said attack, Max would attack until I called him off. Belgian Malinois dogs are sturdier than other working dog breeds. They have less medical problems than German Shepherds and weigh 20 pounds less. 20 pounds is a lot when the dog is harnessed to you during an airborne insertion and you hit the ground, or have to carry a wounded dog to safety. The jihadis had seized control of the airport, and our mission was to clean them out. I was only a few feet in front of Sergeant Maria McGill, a feisty Latin-slash-Irish beauty who was as good on the battlefield as she was in bed. Yeah, we got too close, and she got too serious. She also wanted me to see a shrink, and that dog won't hunt. I wasn't serious about anything but Max and killing the enemy, so we broke up. It kind of made for a tense situation on the battlefield that no one needed. Murph, Corporal Billy Murphy, was beside Maria, and then the rest of the squad followed. Max slowly walked around the burned-out husks of cars and rubble as he sniffed for explosives. The odor from the burning diesel fuel and tires sometimes masked the odor from plastic explosives. The fumes burned my nose and eyes. Max discovered the IED and reacted as he had been trained. He stopped, sat, and pointed his nose at the explosive. This warned me, and I shouted out, "My dog alerted!" and motioned for the squad to stop, but a bit too late. Searing heat and a blast wave hit my body. I heard Max yelp in pain and go silent. The explosion shredded my left boot and hurled my bruised and battered body against an overseas shipping container. Yes, I could see my life passing by as I flew through the air. I dropped to the pavement feeling as though someone had kicked me in the crotch and run over me with a garbage truck. I landed on my back on top of some rubble, and something snapped in my back. The thick blood running into my eyes rendered me blind, and I couldn't move a muscle. The air was full of dust, and the odor from burned cordite was pungent. I thought I was dead. Wait, I thought. Dead people can't hear the sounds of the battle raging around them. Dead people can't smell the burning odor of cordite or the smell of iron as the thick blood oozed under my nose. That's when I laughed to myself and thought, I am alive, and these bastards didn't kill me. Well, not yet anyway. I blinked my eyes and saw Maria laying a few feet from me with blood on her face. I could see a medic attending to her. My heart sank until she looked up at me and smiled. I tried to speak, but couldn't, so I waved. Several of my friends in the squad I was assigned to were wounded, but no one died because of the IED blast. Max, my canine friend, had saved us all. I laid there, trying to reach for him, but I couldn't move. I was afraid Max had died in the blast. I tried to move when I heard the medics arrive. I could vaguely feel my arm when one started an IV. I sure as hell felt the searing pain in my back when they rolled me onto the stretcher. Then I heard one say, "Stop! There's a piece of metal sticking out of his back." I heard my shirt and undershirt being torn so the medic could survey the wound, and then suddenly another sharp pain when the medic pulled the metallic shard from my back. I was on my side receiving a temporary patch when I heard a woman's voice. "Hurry up! He's got bleeding from his crotch area." Now wait a darn minute. That's not something a guy wants to hear as he remembered the feeling of being kicked in the crotch just before he was blown through the air. Naturally, my mind wandered to what specific part of my body was bleeding. I tried to get my lips to ask the question when I felt a stab in my hip and heard, "This man is a hero, according to what his buddies tell me. We need to save him. This will deaden his pain, as you..." My mind became fuzzy as I tried to ask, "As you what? What the heck were they doing?" That was the last thing I remember until a couple of days later. I was flown to a U.S. Air Force hospital in Iceland, a few miles outside of Reykjavik. It had replaced the one in Ramstein, Germany, after the first Iranian terrorist invasion of Germany. Germany had the U.K. drop a small tactical nuke in the area close to the base. It killed over 100,000 of the invaders that were staged there to invade the rest of Europe. The war was very complicated because Iran and Syria used proxy fighters from all over the world to do their fighting, until we began whipping their butts. The United Nations fought against attacking Iran and Syria because they weren't actually fighting. The fix was in at the UN, and the USA and Great Britain lost every vote, thanks to the Russians and French. I don't remember any of my stay in Reykjavik till the day before we were to fly back stateside. I remember waking up with the sun shining in my eyes and hearing a din of voices. They were all mixed up, and for several minutes, words just blended. I was drowsy from the painkillers, but finally opened my eyes to see a pretty nurse reading to me. The book covered half of her gorgeous face. I watched her lips move, but could only hear the roar of a million sounds from the battlefield. She smelled like lilacs and honey, and had corn silk-colored hair. Her skin was smooth-looking and blemish-free. I think I fell in love with her. Okay, maybe lust crept in there a bit, but like a dog chasing a car, I couldn't do much about it. Suddenly, the other noises went away, and I heard a voice crystal clear. "Has declared war on Syria and Iran. The president is expected to sign the declaration of war this morning. Iran and Syria, with Russian support, just landed over 100,000 troops in England. The bill includes a provision to restart the military draft, and will include women for the first time in U.S. history." Oh my, I'm glad I'm already a nurse, or I might be drafted to shoot people. Anyway, those are today's headlines. I smiled at the pretty nurse and tried to speak. Felt my jaw try to move a bit, but words didn't come out of my mouth. I heard the nurse, "Don't try to talk. Your commanding officer has put in papers for a medal. You saved a dozen of your fellow soldiers from probable death. You've been through a lot of surgery to your foot, back, and mouth. Oh, you'll recover okay, but your jaw is wired shut. You have had dental implants inserted to replace the teeth you lost. Now, rest." I wanted to ask her 100 questions. Where is Max? How long have I been here? Why is there stabbing pain in my foot, groin, and back? Are you single? Why can't I move my left leg? Where are my buddies? Would you date a patient? Where is Max? Then I heard her say something into her cell phone.
Yes, he woke up and tried to speak. He appears to be in pain, as expected. Okay, I'll increase the IV sedation. I'll see you at the hotel tonight.
I now knew a doctor had beaten me to the pretty nurse, and I watched her increase the rate of the medicine dripping into my IV. A calm feeling washed over me when I heard a strange man's voice. He's under. Now we can move him into the medical pod without causing him too much pain. They're shipping him back to the States today. The lucky bastard is going to that new VA hospital in Nashville, near his hometown. I'll take over. That was the last thing I remember. Crap. The only thing I remember about my 9 days in Iceland. It placed me in a medical pod transportation vehicle and shipped me to the airport. All I knew is that I was going home. I was born and raised in the Nashville, Tennessee area, and lived in several small towns before my dad and mom settled down outside of Water Hill, Tennessee. I lived there until I joined the Army. I had a great childhood and loved living in Middle Tennessee, but joined the Army instead of going to college as my brother and sister did. It wasn't that I was dumb or anything. I just didn't like sitting in class every day. I wanted some excitement, and when I got bored, I manufactured the excitement. Naturally, I stayed in trouble in high school, but was never caught at my best pranks on fellow students and teachers. March 25, 2038. TSHTF, or Day Zero. Aboard a KC-135 at 25,000 feet, about 150 miles from Nashville, Tennessee. I wakened to the sound of the droning engines and knew I was on a plane. My home was just outside of Nashville, and I was confident they would take me to the new VA hospital there. Then, sadness washed over me because I still didn't know if Max was alive or what had happened to him. I bumped my elbow against my pod, and one of the medics rushed over to tend to me. I called out to him the best I could with my jaw wired shut.
Medic! Medic!
I called out, or something that sounds like that. He stared down at me with a confused look. The other medic came over.
He's in a canine unit, and I think he wants to know how Max is doing. Sergeant Walker, Max is actually on this plane and is recovering nicely. He'll stay on the plane and fly on to Lackland Air Force Base, where they have vets who specialize in canine injuries and rehabilitation. I'd love to let you see him, but neither of you is in any shape to move from your transport pods.
That made me feel better, and I mumbled,
"Thank you,"
to the medics. Max was alive, and I would do anything to see him again. I knew I had to work hard to get myself healed, and then I could go to Lackland and see my pup. It was several hours later, and the medics and crew were discussing some troubling world news that had occurred while I'd been sleeping, under the influence of potent sedatives and painkillers. One man told another that Russia warned the USA not to attack Syria or Iran. Russia threatened massive retaliation if their allies were attacked. The UK, Germany, France, and the USA had launched hundreds of cruise missiles, bombers, and fighters to pound the two countries. Later that night, the plane lurched a couple of times. Lightning flashed and lit up the cabin. The clap of thunder followed a few seconds later. One of the crewmen mentioned the aircraft we were on was a KC-135. It was 73 years old and due to retire 2 years ago. But the war in Europe had caused the military to extend using them. I thought, oh crap, I'm in a plane older than my grandfather flying across the ocean in a major thunderstorm. Then I heard a woman's voice.
Prepare your patients for landing. We'll be told to head to our jump seats in 10 minutes.
I listened to the conversation when abruptly there was a blinding flash from the windows. The lights went out, and sparks flew around the inside of the plane. The flash was gone, but I couldn't see. There was a buzz of yelling and directions given, but no one panicked. The medics and doctor tried their best to prepare their patients for the inevitable crash. However, they remained calm in the face of death and destruction. The plane lurched, and I felt the sickening feeling that I was falling. The medics scrambled around in the dark and closed the medical pod next to me, and then began closing mine. I heard him say, "That last blast of light wasn't from the storm. I turned your meds up, and you'll be zonked out before we hit the ground. Good luck, you lucky bastard." I felt the plane level off a bit and then start a slow glide down when my mind became fuzzy, and everything went black. The pod snapped closed, and now I had complete darkness and silence. I can remember to this day, the medic called me a lucky bastard just before the plane was going to crash. At the time, my fuzzy mind thought it was a sick joke. Now I fully understand his meaning. I had nightmares so real that I couldn't tell if I was living the events or dreaming. One I'll never forget, but won't tell anyone, had me hunting the enemy with Max. There were two jihadis, and we snuck up behind them and jumped on them. I could see myself tearing the man's neck apart with my fangs. I turned to see Max had his man by the wrist. I shook my man until the blood stopped gushing from his neck. I felt the rush of the kill, and then the crush of guilt for so savagely killing the man. I'd had similar dreams before. I was tired of killing, and needed the nightmares to stop. Obviously, the huge airplane crashed a few minutes later, but I was oblivious to the carnage. I remember dreaming about that cute nurse back in Iceland after I woke up a couple of days later, but nothing about the crash. What I will never forget to this day was the pain once the drugs wore off. Oh my God, how I hurt all over. I had mind-numbing pain in my foot, back, and, well, the rest of my body felt like it had been beaten with a baseball bat. My eyes opened, and there was no light. I couldn't hear anything either. I thought maybe I was dead, but then I thought, why am I in so much pain? I tried to move, and the pain from my back and left foot shot daggers through my body. Wait, I saw something glowing to my left. I thought, what is that? I thought I heard my voice, and it shocked me for a second. I reached out to the glowing object and grasped it in my right hand. I'd been locked in the trunk of a car by my high school drinking buddies one night, so I knew this must be the emergency release to get my ass out of this contraption. I pulled as hard as I could, even though the pain increased tremendously. Suddenly, the top rose, and stars twinkled above me, and a chilly wind blew on my face. I smelled burnt fuel and another pungent odor I didn't recognize. I tried to lift myself, but the pain was so intense, I passed out. The nightmares started again. Later, I dreamed I was swimming in the Atlantic off Cape Cod in the winter. Someone on shore kept yelling for me to swim faster or I'd die. I was shivering and felt ice-cold rain pelting my face. My face was numb, my body was soaked, and I knew I would die if I didn't get out of the rain and change clothes. My eyes opened, and I could barely see a few yards from the pod. I saw a flickering light through the rain and gloom, and decided it was a fire. I raised my head slightly and saw the side of the aircraft. Holy shit! That's only the hind quarter of the plane, I thought. I have to get out of this cold rain, or I'll die. My IV pumps vibrated as they pumped liquids into my body, but the round ball-like pain pump was now flat and empty. I was receiving fluids, but no pain meds. That's why I wasn't all cotton-mouthed, but was in intense pain. I also found my urine bag for my catheter. Pulling the IV from my arm was a non-event, but removing the catheter from my, was quite the experience. You don't need every little detail. Just suffice it to say that was one experience that I never want to repeat. Enough said. I searched the pod for anything useful without success. I felt my legs and torso to find I only wore a hospital gown and nothing else. I didn't even want to think about dragging my unprotected family jewels across the wet mud and wreckage to get to safety. Laugh all you want, but even a half-dead man has to have his priorities in order. I tugged on a wide strip of padding from the pod above my head and ripped a 3-foot-wide-by-4-foot-long section of the half-inch thick padding away. I used the IV tubing to secure it to the front of my waist. Yeehaw! Family jewels are now protected. I started to move out of the pod, but stopped when I realized my knees weren't protected either. So I pulled more of the padding from the side of the pod and wrapped the material around both legs. I also packed a piece of the padding around my left foot to keep the muddy water from reaching my wounds. My left arm wasn't much use, but I could hold the material in place while I secured it with my right hand. I used two pieces for my right leg so I could stay flexible as I attempted to crawl to the plane. I was very proud of myself by now and exclaimed to myself, "Damn, I'm a regular genius. I've made armor from a glorified burial casket lining." Yes, I was beginning to talk to myself more and more as time went on that day. No, I wasn't talking as much as thinking, but I could hear myself, and that was all that was important at the time. My left arm and leg wouldn't cooperate and screamed at me with every movement. I used my right arm to lift my torso over the edge of the pod and pushed with my right leg until I flopped out of the pod onto my left side. "Son of a bitch, that hurts! Oh, God, kill me now and get this over with," I mumbled in agony. I later thanked God for not honoring my request. I even promised to be a good boy if he'd let me live long enough to see my mom and dad once again. The rain pounded me as I laid there on the muddy ground for a few minutes. I had to build up the courage to withstand the pain, and I prepared myself mentally to crawl to the wrecked fuselage. I only had my right arm and leg to push against the ground, since it was unthinkable to endure the pain from my left side. The padding was covered in vinyl, so most of my lower body stayed dry above the mud for most of the trip. The sun rose in the sky and shined dimly through the rain and gloomy skies. I stopped several times to rest along the way. At least my movement seemed to be warming me up a bit. I paused for the last time, only a few feet from the plane, when I bumped up against something soft. Crap, it was one of the medics. I crawled around him and tried to see if I recognized him, but he had no face, or head, for that matter. I gagged and tried not to retch while I passed him in the cold, driving rain. The rain stopped hitting my back, and I looked up to see that I was finally under what remained of the roof of the aircraft. The main floor of the aircraft was several feet above the ground, so I stopped and made myself comfortable in what had to be a storage compartment below the main level. There was enough light to see by, and I took stock of my surroundings. There was a puddle of water on the slick aluminum floor, and I drank until the puddle was gone. It tasted a bit metallic with a hint of high-grade jet fuel. It quenched my thirst, and that was what I needed at the time. I would drink from much worse sources over the next few years. I found several duffel bags full of clothes and made a bed, then pulled several coats on top of myself and passed out. Time passed. I woke up a lot warmer, but still wet. I had no clue when we'd crashed or where I was at the time. I just knew I was damp and needed something to eat. The padding came off without much effort, but rolling around to get the hospital gown off and drying my body was excruciatingly painful. The great news was I performed a self-examination of my privates, and everything was still in place. But I had a painful wound near my groin at the top of my left leg. My fear of being a eunuch was unfounded, to my immense relief. I know I bitch about the pain a lot, but being blown up and slammed against a shipping container does a body bad. So, get used to the complaints because you have a couple more chapters of pain complaints and can kiss my redneck ass if you don't like it. Just hang in there, Buttercup, and the pain will ease as time goes on. But then, all healing takes time. I had a bunch of mental healing to go through also. I could feel the pain, but would eventually make others feel my mental pain. Now, back to the pain generated by dressing myself. Damn it, it hurt a bunch. I couldn't find underwear or shoes, but managed to put on a long-sleeve t-shirt and sweatshirt, plus some loose-fitting jeans. I kept rummaging through the cargo and found a nice hooded parka and several pair of socks. I also found a couple of shaving kits and a pocket knife. My left foot was wrapped in bandages, so I placed a couple of socks on my right foot. I threw a change of clothes into an empty duffel bag, along with the shaving kits, and tossed it up onto the main floor before attempting the climb. Finally, I made it to my foot. I won't say feet, because my left foot just dangled, entirely unusable at the time. I hopped to the side and inched my way up the curve of the fuselage until my waist was even with the floor. I moved my duffel bag over to cover the jagged metal and leaned over until I caught myself with my right hand and lowered myself to the floor. What I saw made me sick to my stomach. Chapter 2. Walter Hill, Tennessee. Jason's parents' home. Jason's parents, Zach and Jan Walker, were sleeping when the sirens blared through the darkness. Since a storm had just passed over Walter Hill, Zach jumped out of bed in case there was a tornado alert. He turned the TV to Channel 5 and then yelled for Jan to turn the emergency radio on. Both had the same message. The USA is under attack, and citizens should shelter in place. The message was much longer, but didn't give Zach a clue as to what was actually happening in the world. Then he remembered that he had the DVR set to record his favorite late-night news show. He punched the buttons to start the show and saw his beloved talking head discussing the U.S. and British attack on Syria and Iran. This scared Zach, but he kept listening when, suddenly, the man said, "I just heard that Russia has attacked our military bases in Italy, Great Britain, and Iraq. Our military is counterattacking as I speak." The message was cut short, and then the U.S. president gave a brief message, imploring his fellow Americans to take cover because the U.S. was under attack. There was a brilliant flash followed by a low rumble beneath their feet. The news stopped abruptly, the TV died, and the lights went out. Zach and Jan ran outside to see if their neighbors' lights were out. They saw an unearthly glow in the sky to the north, and then another to the southeast.
"Jan, I think those were nuclear blasts. Get inside, close all the windows, and fill the bathtubs and sinks with water. Fill any container you can find with water. I'm going to the barn. I'll be right back."
Jan busied herself with collecting water when she remembered to call her sister up in Chicago to make sure they were okay. She picked up her iPhone XX and touched the home button. Nothing happened. So she went to the bedroom and took her husband's phone from the nightstand after disconnecting the charger. She tried to make a call, and his phone was dead also. Jan was confused and worried now. She tried her Fitbit watch, but it was dead along with every electronic device in the home. She ran to the upstairs bathroom and turned the water off just before the tub overflowed. Next, she checked the downstairs bathtub and waited a few minutes before it was full. Jan was pleased when her husband returned from the garage with a bag and his Coleman lantern shining bright. It lit up the room.
"Darling, use this duct tape to seal the windows and doors while I go bring in more supplies and food in from the pole barn. We need to assume we were nuked and keep the radioactive fallout out of the house. I'll be back in a few minutes."
Jan watched her husband calmly work to make them safe and was very proud of him because he always knew what to do. They had married 35 years ago, raised their three kids, and paid for two of them to go to college. Zach was a maintenance manager at a distribution center in Lebanon, and together they earned a good living. They were working hard and saving for their retirement when the lights went out. Zach had purchased 26 acres on Las Casas Pike toward Auburn Town off a side road. There was a small, older cabin on the property, and Jan and he stayed there every chance they got. He had dammed a small creek to make a 5-acre lake, built a pole barn, and planned to build a modest home on the property before they retired. They had chickens, a few pigs, and a milk cow. They planned to add more stock. The property wasn't far away, so Zach or Jan dropped by every day to care for the animals and tend their garden. Jan had even learned to churn butter. Zach wasn't a nutty doomsday prepper, but he did believe in being prepared for disasters. He thought the country was headed in the wrong direction with all of the wars, and worried the fighting would spill over to America. His mechanic skills came in handy while fixing up the farm and preparing it for them to live off the grid. He repaired the old tractor and most of the old farm equipment. Their youngest son, Jason, had joined the army and had only been home twice a year for the last 10 years. Their other son, Mike, lived in Atlanta and came back with his wife and two kids about once every 3 months. Their daughter, Michelle, lived in Clarksville, and only visited with her boyfriend on holidays and special occasions. Jan wished the kids lived much closer, but had given up on having them around much anymore. Zach came back into their home with another Coleman lantern lighting up the darkness.
"Honey, come help me pack this stuff into the spare bedroom."
Jan replied.
Zack, is it wise to have these lights on? If you are right about the country being nuked. Remember, Jason and I like those post-apocalyptic novels.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?